The connection between CB McDonald and Seth Rayner. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened?
Yeah, so in order to understand that, you have to understand Chicago Golf was founded by a guy named Charles Boyd McDonald, and he laid out the first golf course, both at Belmont, Downers Grove, which was our first location, and then here in Wheaton. And when he did that, it was a pretty rudimentary affair. I mean, it was basically putting a stick in the ground here and calling it a tee, and putting a stick in the ground there and calling it a green, and say, okay, you know, have at it, hit from one to the other. And over time, bunkers were added and things like that, but it was still pretty rudimentary as it would compare to today's golf course. The other thing about golf courses in those days was they were set up to test, to penalize poor play. And in the early days of golf, and any, you know, any beginner would relate to this, getting the ball in the air is a huge part of you know, your transition as a player. And those early penal, you know, quote unquote, Victorian golf courses were set up to penalize players that couldn't get the ball in the air. If you were an expert player and you could get the ball in the air, it was rather easy. And so even with even with our evolution, the golf course got left behind. Now, then it's important to talk about McDonald and what happened to leave the golf course behind. So in about 1901, there was a conversation in the UK in a magazine among a lot of golf experts, Harry Vardon, Harold Hilton, a bunch of other guys, about what constituted the best holes. And there was an amateur from Oxford named John Lowe, who took the position, and he was very respected because he was on the R&A rules board of things. He took the position that, you know, what you should really set up is more options in golf, strategic options in golf. So if I only hit it so far, you're going to tell me I can hit it over there. Now, that's still going to give me some number of challenges that would be different than the one if I hit it farther and I can hit it in another direction. But strategic golf architecture was what he was proposing be adopted. And McDonald, he left Chicago in about 1900, and he was an avid reader of this series. And over time, he became a good friend of John Lowe's, and he totally bought into this notion. And his twist to it was, as he thought about it, now he had gone to school in St. Andrews, and he'd been all over the UK playing golf. But his twist was he wanted to build one golf course with 18 great holes, not one golf course with, you know, we got a good hole here, a good hole there, and the rest of them are kind of middling. And he did that. And what that became was the National Golf Links of America in Long Island. And that was the first really strategic golf course in the United States. Now, McDonald was a stockbroker, and he worked at the Board of Trade. And so he certainly wasn't going to get his hands dirty moving dirt and things. And he had hired, at that time, he hired a local civil engineer on Long Island named Seth Rayner just to survey the ground. And over time, he realized what an amazing talent this guy was as a civil engineer. And so he taught Rayner all he knew about golf courses and about golf strategy, to the point where he turned, you know, Rayner became his protege. And there are a number of, there's about 15 McDonald, you know, what are called McDonald courses in the world, like the National Golf Links. There are about 15 of those. Every one of those was actually worked on and built, physically built by Seth Rayner and obviously laborers and things. And over time, McDonald really didn't want to be in the business of building golf courses, but there was a great demand for it in the teens and 20s. And he turned the business over to Rayner. And so he had taught Rayner how to build golf courses and the ideas behind building golf courses. And then Rayner ran with it, and Rayner crisscrossed the country. He essentially, and the really unfortunate thing about him is he essentially worked himself to death. He was on a train going all across the country, to Bermuda, to Hawaii, and he died in 1926 at age 51. So he had another 20 some odd years of productive work ahead of him that the golf community, lost. Probably the best example of that is he did the initial routing for Cypress Point, and you know, he died before he could go build it, and then Alistair McKenzie built it using some of his concepts and some, obviously, a lot of his own. But he was one of the real stars of what would today we would call the golden age of golf course architecture with Tillinghast and Mackenzie. Rainer was on that list. Now, I said that Chicago Golf had realized that its course had been left behind, and it wanted to have somebody come in and look at it and come up with a different plan. They had Harry Colt come in, for a day or two in the early 1910s. But they sent a letter to McDonald in 1917 where he said, he responded by saying, "I've long wondered when you were going to come to your senses and realize that your course is among the worst in the country. And the only guy to fix it is my protege, Seth Rainer. He's going to come at a cost of $100 a day and stay out of his way." Unfortunately, World War I happened, and so it took a little longer than that. But in spring of 1921, Rainer came, and he had done some initial planning around World War I, and he brought that back. And the ultimate moment in our golf course history is when he first arrives back at Wheaton, and he realizes he's going to have to build a course on this rolling, wide open prairie site. And he's never worked on anything like that. He's moved a lot of, he literally built the Lido, which we hear about at Sand Valley. He built that out of a tidal marsh. He built the National Golf Links. He had also, done a lot of work at Yale, moving rock, but he'd never worked in that kind of thing. And so he sat in our clock tower for two full days, sketching out how he was going to do it. And then he went out and he created the golf course that we know today. And so course rankings are a funny thing. It's one of the top, you tell me, 10 or 15 courses in the United States. And we're very proud of it.
So one of the things that strikes me when you talk about CB McDonald's first design for Belmont mm-hmm. is that, as you said, Chicago Golf is more of a prairie style flat. Belmont, though, there's a lot of undulation. There's a lot of ups and downs to that. Was it just a factor of that was just a location that they chose to start with at the Belmont site?
Yeah, I mean, really, there were two reasons, I think, from my research, that they picked the Belmont site. Number one was that it was somebody he knew who happened to be a Scotsman who owned a livestock farm and let him use it. And number two, it was close to a rail yard. So if you've been to the Downers Grove Golf Club or Belmont Golf Club, it's, 200-300 yards from a train station that exists today. Now, when they moved to Wheaton again, they bought a livestock farm, and it's interesting because our property gets pegged as being flat and uninteresting, people call it, but there's 45, 48 feet of elevation change mm-hmm. from point A to point B. And when you trace through the evolution of how Rainer planned the golf course from his very first idea of what would design it, he used the elevation changes, and there's a natural ridge in the property that he used to really maximize the effect of the elevation we do have, to the point where, I'll have people that will come and they'll play it for the first time, and they'll say to me, no more than the fourth hole, they'll say, "I was told this was dead flat. I haven't had a flat lie yet, and this doesn't feel flat. And not everything, every shot is uphill." And so it's deceiving that way. But it's a big, wide open, rolling prairie that you can see from one end to the other. Which, especially, once the prairie grasses come in and late in the afternoon with the setting sun, it's just a beautiful. It's just a beautiful location, and having the access to those wide open vistas can be stunning. And the other aspect of it, of course, is that being, open, the full effect of the wind hits your golf ball, and the holes move in different directions. So you've got every wind direction that you can conceive of is going to hit you at least once in the round.
So you mentioned strategy options. One of the things that I think most traditional courses, modern courses, factor in a lot is water. There's not a lot of water at Chicago Golf Club. What was the premise behind that?
Well, their style of architecture didn't necessarily call for water. Now they built their golf, the McDonald Rainer courses are built all over. So, and they use the natural topography, and they use the natural, whatever water was there. So obviously they built Fisher's Island, which is out on the sea, on the ocean. That's going to have a lot of ocean. In our case, there was a watering hole for that the livestock used before we even bought it. That was, I'm sure, pretty small and muddy, and that had been a central element in the golf course that preceded. So McDonald routed one and then ultimately two holes across it. But the idea was that they were just going to use that. I'm sure there was a cost element to it too, because but it was also not. If there were lots of man-made water hazards or retention ponds, it wouldn't have fit in with the prairie site. The one thing they did do is that they extend the pond we did have, the watering hole we had, they expanded it, so that today is the 10th hole plays across that part. And the ninth hole that precedes it also plays across a small water hazard, but that was actually man-made. And the reason they did that was because they built that to be part of the irrigation system, and they built that as in essence a storage pond that they would let the water put it, go in and warm up in the sun. So not a lot of water. And our golf course is not tricky at all. It's what you see is there. There's a couple of blind shots, but no, nothing too bad. But what makes it spectacular are the greens and the green surrounds and what goes on internal to the greens and how you have to get there. That's what makes it special.
So let's talk about the writing of the book. When you found, well, actually, how did you find your co-writer? How did you guys connect on this project?
Well, I've known of Rangeris. So Rangeris worked at the USGA for 30 plus years, and he ran the USGA Museum. And I was in a room with him once or twice, I think, in 2005 when we had the Walker Cup, and potentially in 2018 when we had the Senior Women's Open. And my conception of him at the time was, wow, if he's here, then we're really at crunch time, because he had a pretty wide portfolio of things like communications that reported to him. Writing a book was not on our radar screen, and it was suggested to us by a couple people. And then I did a little bit of work trying to flesh out what would we even talk about, because we didn't want to write a club history in the sense of, this person joined now and this person used to drink this drink on this tee. We didn't want to get into any of that. And so I did some initial work, but I knew that while I had done 10 or 15 years worth of research, and I knew the story elements, and I had a good level of confidence in being able to write a sentence, I knew that I would need help in telling the story compellingly. And compellingly is not just the words, but obviously the images, and we ended up having a lot of diagrams, and I needed somebody to collaborate. And I knew of Rangeris. I knew that he had just recently left the USGA. And I was introduced to him by another historian that the two of them are now two of the three or four people in the world who consult with clubs on how to curate and celebrate and communicate their history, a guy named David Normwell. So David introduced me to Rand, and Rand was nice enough to agree to work with us. And I think our mantra from the beginning was we didn't want to write a cookie cutter book, and all books are great. That's not my point, but we wanted to write something that was special and that was unique to Chicago golf, because Chicago golf is unique to other places. Just like I would think if you were at any name your other club, you would want to have something unique to your club. And over time, we really spent a lot of time on certainly the writing of it, and certainly collecting images. And I'll talk at some point about the artists that helped us with that. But we really worked very diligently on what's the most compelling way for us to tell the story, even if it's not the way somebody else has ever told a golf story before. So that was a real emphasis. And I will mention that. So we've been very fortunate to be friends with a guy named Andy Johnson. You would know him as the Fried Egg. A guy named John Cavalier, people would know him as Lynx Gems, and a guy from Blue Mound up in Milwaukee named Jerry Rossi, who are all really talented in a lot of ways, but especially golf photographers. And of course, drone level golf photography has not only changed golf photography as a thing, but it's also changed people's understandings of golf courses too. And so we were very fortunate that the three of them over a period of probably about 2 or 3 years had taken a lot of really amazing images of our golf course.
Channel stream lawn and power.
Oops, sorry for the phone call. You can pick up my lawnmower for you if you'd like. So we had had that. The other person that was really important to the process was we knew we wanted some diagrams, and part of doing this book was leaving a record behind that would be useful for 50 years from now, 100 years from now, about what, not just what the golf course was at a moment in time, but how it got here. And so Don Plasek, who works for Tom Doak, is an amazing, he's an amazing golf architect, and he's an amazing golf artist, and he does all their blueprint work and things like that. And so he contributed a lot of, in their hand drawn new drawings that they're really amazing. So he made an amazing contribution. And then probably the last person to talk to before the publisher is Anthony Pioppi. Is there's a small group of McDonald Rainer historians, and yes, there is such a world a thing in the world as a group of McDonald Rainer historians, and Rainer left no paper behind. I mean, Alistair Mackenzie, Donald Ross, they wrote books, they wrote for papers, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of written documentation. Rainer was so busy, and he was such a quiet, unassuming man that he left no paper behind. So it's important to have those people. So Anthony has been a friend and a contributor to my learning over time. And so Anthony was nice enough to contribute his writing of the essentially a biographical sketch of Rainer, so that people, because this is a story not just of blades of grass, it's a story of the people that built it, and Rainer being a great example, the foremost example of that.
So, having written a couple books myself, I kind of understand a little bit of the process, not in the scope that what you've gone through, but I also know that it's a massive undertaking and that at the end of it, there's fatigue. When you finished the book, what was when you got to hold the book actually in your hand and see the final product, what did you feel?
Again, I didn't expect to write a book, and obviously, I knew that at some point that was going to happen, and I had been part of all the proof process and all that, so I had an idea of what it was going to look like. But to hold it in my hands, and we had selected the paper, we had gotten into everything, but to hold all 5 pounds in my hand and to see the scale of it was pretty cool. Actually, the coolest part was it came together very quickly. So it actually it, from when Rand and I started together until it showed up, in the delivery truck in Wheaton, was less than 2 years. And so that was pretty quick. Now, there was a lot of years of research before that, but that was actually pretty quick. The months and months of questions from my friends and fellow members, when's the book going to be done? Being able to put it in their lockers and know that, within, X hours from when I was doing that they were actually going to see it. That was by far the best feeling. And then the other aspect, which kept me busy for a while, is we decided to, and this was April of 2024, we decided to make it available to people outside our membership. And so we sold about 500, or actually now more, copies externally via like a Shopify site, and I was the customer fulfillment and the shipping department and all that stuff. That actually, it wasn't it was I was the most tired after that. I didn't have time to be tired until after I got through that. But being able to share it with people and have people appreciate it was really amazing, and it's been fun. I really appreciate the people who I can tell have read it. And have consumed not just the words and not just the pictures, but the words and pictures together, because then they really get the story.
So, having won the Herbert Warren Wind Award, does that change now what the future of the book looks like? Are you going to continue to sell it, or what's the plan going forward?
Well, I mean, we will continue to sell it in our pro shop for however long anybody wants to buy it. We have opened up for a limited time. We've opened up. Reopened the Shopify site, and we're selling some. The USGA is selling some, because we understand that there's going to, this the announcement will have had a pop up on people's radar screen for the first time. But as we're a small little place, and we're going to go back to being a small little place. We've gone, Rand and I went way out of our way, and the club, more importantly, went out way out of its way to share the golf course in a really special way with lots of people that may or may not ever see it. And I think we tried to be very respectful and very communicative with folks who, whether they would or wouldn't see it, so that, you know, that we could share, you know, not just what Seth Rayner did, but what the care of all the people that paid for it in the first place. And the other part of the story I haven't mentioned that I would be remiss is we decided it was very important, because it is an important element of the story, to tell the agronomic story of the golf course and how the golf course evolved over time. And a golf course is a living organism, just like your yard is a living organism. And it, what happens isn't just above the grass you see. It, a lot of it is what goes on below the surface. And we've right now we have our Craig Smith as our seventh superintendent in those 100 and now 102 years, which is pretty amazing. And to tell their aspect of the story was very special too. There's a superintendent somewhere else in the country who essentially challenged us to say, you know, nobody tries to tell that story, and if they do, they get it wrong. And so we took it as a great challenge to get it right, and we think we have, at least in the context of our club and what's happened.
Oh, one more question, then I have a couple rapid fire questions for you. With regard to, say, you're talking about irrigation in the club itself, how does the club approach, like, say, if you're, I thought I saw on the Facebook page of maybe a few years ago, you were doing some irrigation work. How do you decide on what work to done to do, considering the historic nature of this course?
Well, most of what I'm actually talking about is aerification, which is in the fairways and on the greens, you know, taking plugs out and taking dead roots out and filling it with sand. That's actually the most thing. Certainly we did, you know, if you have a golf course, there are a handful of golf courses in the world that can get away. Fisher's Island is another Rayner, which is an example that doesn't have an irrigation system. But there are very few that can get away with having none. And they have a limited lifespan. And ours had in 2020, ours was beyond its limited lifespan. So that's the most recent addition of that. And that's actually a real, I honestly don't know a heck of a lot about that. That's a real science in terms of where you want to place heads, how, you know, where you get the water from, the water pressure. And it's, you know, my grandfather was a plumber, and that was, you know, that would have been like a PhD level course for him. So but you have to do that. It's a necessary element of running a place that people are going to want to come to play.
So the rapid fire questions are a little unfair, because you could probably talk a long time about this, okay, but maybe you could just give an anecdote or something with regard to it. Maybe talk about the Follis brothers and the impact of that. All these people, how many were involved in the club, and how did that happen?
There were, so the Follis brothers, the father was Old Tom Morris's foreman in St. Andrews. The brother Jim came to be our first professional and won the second U.S. Open. His brother David came. His brother John came and was, and David came to be the co-professional and eventually the professional and superintendent. John came to be a bookkeeper. They're buried, most of the family is buried within 100 yards of our entrance in the Wheaton Cemetery. They were very central, and they, Jim and David Follis, the two brothers, earned two patents. They also did all the golf course work between 1895 and 1916 when David left to go to Hinsdale, and they were instrumental in our history.
Chick Evans, what's the impact? I believe Chick Evans might have caddied there at a specific event. Was he involved at all with Chicago Golf?
Yeah, he was a member at a point. So from 1916 until 1923, he was a member of Chicago Golf, and I'll work backwards from there. And he played he got to the finals of the 1912 U.S. Amateur and lost. He got to the semifinals at Chicago Golf Club. He got to the semifinals of the 1909 U.S. Amateur and lost. In his words, his first time, he came to caddy in the 1903 U.S. Women's Amateur for the woman who lost in the finals. And he was a very active member of our club community. He would come to, you know, caddy banquets, and he was on different committees, and he called people up to tell them that they had done something wrong, all that stuff. He was a very active member of our community. And frankly, he's one of my golf heroes. So that's, to me, he, you know, he's a big part of our history.
And then finally, can you talk a little bit about the U.S. Women's Open and the impact and the future, and I'm assuming there's probably some strategy going on right now that the club's thinking about.
Yeah, so we will be the host site for the 2033 U.S. Women's Open, and that'll be the first time we have held that particular championship. So we've held four different USGA championships and or five, I guess, and then the Walker Cup. So this will be the first time we've held the Women's Open Championship. I'm personally really excited. It'll be a chance to share our golf course with a whole slice of the golf population we haven't before. I'm also very excited because we held the 2018 Senior Women's Open. That was, and I've been at Chicago Golf for almost 50 years now. That was the most special event in those 50 years by far. And so we're really excited to host that and to partner. And of course, as a founding member of the USGA from 1894, to participate with them and to get to work with them and to get to help them, you know, do what they want to do is very special at all. It's going to be a really amazing thing for me because it will be the first time Chicago Golf Club has ever been roped off for a championship. And to see those ropes, I don't know how I'm going to take that. I don't know how our members are going to take that. And I mean that kiddingly, but it'll be an eye opener for us, but we're really excited about that. And frankly, you know, that's far enough in the future that, you know, I keep thinking of, I see teenage stars and thinking of, wow, you're going to be like right in the wheelhouse of our event. But, you know, the golf ball will have changed by then and distances will be what they are. It'd be fascinating to see what it's like. And it's going to be late May and early June. And hopefully we'll have a good winter and we'll be firm and fast like we always intend to be.